Fritz was a convenient target for such attacks, but, in this instance, even his adversaries may have been giving him too much credit. As we have seen, Marsalis's success was more a result of renewed interest in the jazz heritage than its cause. Branford Marsalis's evolving career reflected a careless disregard for the rigid hierarchies espoused by his younger brother. If Winton championed mainstream jazz, Branford played with rock bands. As Winton's music grew more structured, Branford increasingly delighted in loose, blowing dates. When Winton frequented Lincoln Center, Branford took a prominent television gig on The Tonight Show. While Winton focused on the traditional sounds of gospel and blues, Branford experimented with the contemporary sounds of funk and hip-hop. But under the superficial laxity of Branford Marsalis lay a musical mind capable of the most rigorous logic. His melodic lines unfolded with a structural elegance at times reminiscent of Sonny Rollins, developing with clarity and precision, but not without incorporating surprising twists and turns along the way. Although his devil-may-care choice of engagements at times raised concerns about whether he most valued artistry or mere fame, Branford Marsalis's talent could not be doubted. At his best, invariably in small combo jazz settings, he showed that he deserved mention on any shortlist of the finest saxophonists of his generation. At times, it is hard to separate the personal influence of the Marsalis siblings from the institutional impact of record companies hoping to replicate their success stories. These moves, especially those of the CBS label, often took on a formulaic aspect. Eager to find a second Winton, CBS signed Terrence Blanchard, a teenage New Orleans trumpeter who had replaced Marsalis in the Blakey Band and who frequently collaborated with fellow Crescent City jazzman, saxophonist Donald Harrison. Pianist and vocalist Harry Connick Jr., another New Orleans native, was also signed by CBS when barely out of his teens. Connick showed very real talent, especially as a singer, and exuded a rare degree of stage presence for a young musician. Yet these gifts were hyped beyond recognition when the publicity machine tried to anoint him as the next Frank Sinatra, on the basis of a few early, albeit promising, recordings. Trumpeter Marlon Jordan was also signed to the label while still a teenager. His hometown, few will be surprised to learn, was New Orleans. These artists' recordings were often produced by Delfeo Marsalis, who also became an important participant in the expanding New Orleans quarter of the CBS jazz empire. Other labels joined the New Orleans craze, with MCA Impulse promoting Henry Butler, an exciting pianist and vocalist with a dynamic, heartfelt style. Verve signing Nicholas Payton, a sweet-toned trumpeter who was barely out of his teens at the time, and Novus recording the aforementioned Delfeo Marsalis, who showed his skill in playing the trombone in a manner reminiscent of J.J. Johnson. This concept-driven campaign, so obsessively focused on the city scrawled on an artist's birth certificate, threatened to collapse under its own weight. CBS Records, acquired by Sony in 1987, eventually parted ways with almost every one of the New Orleans artists it had signed, including Winton Marsalis. For the most part, the musicians swept up in this Crescent City fever were genuine talents, even if the fame and expectations thrust upon them from the start were new phenomena in the jazz world. As the preceding chapters of this book make clear, many of jazz's greatest figures of previous eras never enjoyed a contract with a major label, and others did so only after mastering their craft the slow way as sidemen in the trenches and on tightly budgeted leader dates for small labels. Some critics feared that the industry's quest for young blood would create a generation of instrumentalists with unripened talent or lacking the deep commitment to a set of musical values that comes only from hard dues paying. Others lamented how many brilliant artists in mid-career, mainstream players born between 1940 and 1955, pianists Jessica Williams, Kenny Barron, Steve Kuhn, and Adam Makowitz, trumpeters Tommy Harrell, Valerie Ponomarev, and Bobby Shaw, saxophonists Bobby Watson, Eric Kloss, Ricky Ford, and Jane Ira Bloom, trombonist Steve Turry, to cite but a few, seemed part of a lost generation who were mostly forgotten by the power brokers and magazines. Seen as too old to be part of the youth movement, but too young to be respected veterans from the early days of jazz. Yet, as subsequent events would confirm, this flowering of the traditionalist movement in jazz was much more than a passing fad or a short-lived marketing angle pursued by the record labels. The concurrent spread and institutionalization of jazz education during this same period no doubt played a key role in this process. At almost the same moment that Winton Marsalis was embracing a more traditional musical vocabulary, the National Association of Jazz, a modest organization of music professionals and teachers, started in the 1960s, changed its name to the grander International Association for Jazz Education, and would build its annual get-together into the single biggest event in the jazz world, a distinction it maintained until the organization's collapse from financial stresses in 2008. Who could have imagined, back in the swing era or jazz age, that the biggest annual jazz party would coalesce around a collection of educators? Equally surprising to old-timers would be the music's journey from the nightclubs of 52nd Street to Lincoln Center. Jazz at Lincoln Center had also started on a small scale, with a budget of less than $1 million when it was established in 1986 as a department of Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. But JALC's budget had grown to more than $40 million by 2008, making it the biggest power broker in the jazz world of the new millennium. These are profound changes, yet in an era of codification, institutionalization, and historical consciousness raising, such shifts should not be surprising. One can measure this transformation in many ways, but perhaps the most obvious sign of the new state of affairs is the proliferation of tribute bands, tribute recordings, reissues, historic boxed sets, reunion tours, and repertory projects. In the old days, an occasional ghost band would work the circuit, usually the result of musicians keeping a group afloat after the death of a prominent leader. But after the return to the roots movements of the 1980s and 1990s, ensembles devoted to the dearly departed seemed to sprout up everywhere, professing allegiances to bygone styles and artists, even if none of the musicians on hand had any first-hand contact with the original source of inspiration. Perhaps it is some consolation to readers of this book that, even though they will never get a chance to see the deceased exponents of jazz past in the flesh, they can almost certainly find a tribute band, whether their tastes run to Cannonball Adderley or Lenny Tristano, Bix Beiderbecke or Herbie Nichols, or some other figure from the last century. How sobering it is to consider that the most momentous jazz milestones of 1959 were the release of classic recordings such as Kinda Blue, Time Out, and Mingus Ah-Um. But, strange to say, the most publicized jazz events of 2009 were the 50th anniversary reissues of these same albums. The Columbia, now Sony label, that had originally presented this fresh and unapologetic music to the public, had by this stage mostly abandoned the idea of promoting any jazz that wasn't a reissue or some marketing-driven concept of minimal substance and credibility. Certainly, there are many jazz fans and performers who would prefer a more revolutionary art form with grander aspirations. Yet, like latecomers to a party after all the best food and drink has been consumed, artists of the current day must make do with what scraps are available, and usually those are elements drawn from the music's heritage. To build a revolutionary new style from these bits and pieces may well be too large a task for even the most talented among them, although a few still aspire to such heights, albeit almost invariably without the support of a major label. Yet, should we demand such perennial revolutions? Is it the jazz world that is amiss, or merely out of perspective? How valid is our ingrained expectation that the music should always be progressive, always break the mold, always embrace the newest new thing? Is it not enough simply for music to be enjoyable, intelligent, well played? On the other hand, if young jazz musicians are content to work within the framework of earlier styles, why should we listen to their compact discs rather than to the history-making performances by Armstrong, Parker, Ellington, and other past masters that serve as the blueprints for these latter-day works? Why pay attention to the imitator when the original is, through the miracle of recording technology, almost as accessible? These are deep questions beyond the scope of this work, and ones that this author hopes to pick up on a later occasion. They are questions, moreover, that are relevant to many arts and genres beyond the world of jazz. It suffices to point out that, after 500 years as a dominant aesthetic vision, the very notion of an art form following a progressive evolution, quasi-scientific in its continual breakthroughs, is now tottering at its foundations. Various New Age, minimalist, and other styles of art, for all their limitations, and though their aesthetic underpinnings are largely unformed, suggest the possibility of a degree zero style, to borrow the terminology of critic Roland Barthes, one that has no relation to the time warp of advancing techniques. In a contemporary vein, other aestheticians have spoken of the arrival of the end of the history of art, a vision that to some represents the glorious advent of a non-linear age of unconstrained creativity, but, to others, implies a frightening abandonment of our previous assumptions and points of reference. The history of jazz is at a critical point where such questions become increasingly important. The music's past threatens to dwarf its present and cloud its future. Only in the last few years, visitors to jazz record stores have encountered a novel situation in which most of the music for sale is by artists who are no longer alive. The surviving jazz radio stations are moving in a similar direction, celebrating the legacy of past masters and putting fewer and fewer current releases into rotation. The rise of movements to propagate the jazz repertory, the emergence of generation after generation of neo-traditionalists, even the interest in jazz historical studies, which validates the work you hold in your hands, these are all symptoms of the same tectonic shift inexorably altering the structure of the jazz world. As a result, any new artist attempting to make a reputation in today's environment must compete not just with other young talents, but with the entire history of the music. That is a heavy burden indeed. Responding to this set of circumstances, an alternative approach to the tradition was espoused by a group of progressive and often irreverent postmodernists during the closing decades of the 20th century. Starting a few years before Wynton Marsalis began his ascent to the pinnacle of jazz fame, these less heralded artists were attempting a more confrontational approach to the various pre-existing styles and vocabularies of jazz. Realizing that the music's weighty tradition could not be avoided completely, these postmodern players nonetheless refused to be mere acolytes celebrating the past. Instead, they applied a deconstructive approach, a willfully manipulative attitude that aimed to transform elements pulled from the jazz and non-jazz musical archives into building blocks for new hybrid sounds. These performers grappled with their musical inheritance not to turn jazz into a museum piece, far from it, but rather seeking oral weapons that still might have the capacity to shock and awe. The Postmodern Impulse. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing, runs a famous aphorism from the ancient poet Archilochus, a saying that inspired Oxford Don Isaiah Berlin to categorize visionary individuals as either foxes or hedgehogs, based on whether their careers emphasize single-minded allegiance to one big concept or constant shifts from idea to idea. The distinction is useful in understanding the postmodern turn in jazz, which aimed to change the art form from the home of heroic hedgehogs into a frenetic free-for-all of fleet foxes. If jazz was built on big personalities with strongly defined individual styles in the waning years of the 20th century, it would be inherited by eclectic improvisers who were comfortable with a range of idioms and could mix and match them depending on the settings or their inclination. Starting in the 1970s, the leaders of the jazz world were increasingly those who knew many things and delighted in the opportunity to show audiences the full range of their musical learnings. The postmodern jazz musician, a figure who exemplified this turn of events, reflecting tendencies also evident in other art forms during this period, inevitably reminds us of those famous linguists who have mastered several languages and can quickly jump from one to the next. Perhaps even this comparison is too tame, since the jazz postmodernists even dared to superimpose incongruous styles one on top of the other, conversations in multiple tongues happening simultaneously, forcing them together into provocative new combinations. Leading jazz performers had rarely done this in earlier decades. They worked to develop personal styles as unique as a fingerprint, and created their individual sound almost as much by their ruthlessness in excluding certain phrases and structures as by what they included. The postmodern turn in jazz, in contrast, stood out for its vast inclusiveness, its reluctance to abandon any avenue of expression, no matter how far from the mainstream. Rather than a single notion of freedom, various freedoms were being asserted across a wide spectrum of musical possibilities, George Lewis has written, offering what could easily serve as a definition of the postmodern impulse in jazz. Even the institutional structures of jazz changed to reflect this new sensibility. Instead of towering individuals who led the jazz world by courageous example, musicians whose very names, Armstrong, Ellington, Parker, Davis, Coltrane, defined and symbolized the evolution of the art form, collectives and associations of various sorts now became the leaders of the progressive wing of the jazz world. The looseness of these confederations reflected the increasingly prevalent open-mindedness to varied methods of musical expression. The formation of the Jazz Composers Guild toward the end of 1964 was an early sign of how this new approach might work. In time, other groups emerged on the scene in different communities, including the Underground Musicians Association in Los Angeles, the Black Artists Group in St. Louis, and the Detroit Creative Musicians Association. But the Chicago-based Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, AACM, would prove to be the most influential of these collectives. The AACM began in 1965 with the aim of helping progressive musicians find performing opportunities, rehearsal space, and other career support. Pianist Mulhall Richard Adams served as the organization's first president. His experimental band, a large free jazz ensemble established in 1961, had helped lay the groundwork for the AACM, and many of Abrams's later recordings would stand out as important statements of the movement's aesthetic vision. Other early participants included Roscoe Mitchell, Joseph Jarman, Anthony Braxton, and Lester Bowie. In its charter as a non-profit organization, approved on August 5, 1965, the AACM outlined 9 purposes, which included the cultivation and training of young musicians, the presentation of concerts and recitals, the creation of employment opportunities for performers, and the fostering of the tradition of cultured musicians handed down from the past. In time, the group would expand its scope to sponsoring recordings, producing radio shows, helping inner-city students, and many other behind-the-scenes efforts of advocacy and community service. Important early recordings documenting the AACM's music included Mitchell's Sound, 1966, Jarman's Song 4, 1967, Bowie's Numbers 1 and 2, 1967, Abrams's Levels and Degrees of Light, 1968, Braxton's Three Compositions of New Jazz, 1968, and the Art Ensemble of Chicago's People in Sorrow, 1969, Tutankhamun, 1969, and A Jackson in Your House, 1969. The title of Mitchell's Sound, a project that helped usher in this new Chicago-based movement, gave testimony to an especially vital aspect of this multifaceted music. Like Albert Ayler, these artists often focused on qualities of sound as opposed to conventional delineations of harmony, melody, and rhythm. Standard notation was insufficient to contain these non-scalar explorations, which to some degree are throwbacks to African and early African American systems of organizing music, given the frequency with which the sonic textures moved beyond the 12 standard tones. Yet this was only one part of the Chicago School's approach. Unlike Ayler and other early avant-gardists, the Chicagoans often downplayed the intensity of so-called energy jazz in favor of a comparatively open sound. They were less enamored with hot solos, that grand tradition invented a half-century earlier in the Windy City, and embraced instead a more layered and episodic approach to composition and performance. Other trademarks of the emerging Chicago school included diverse borrowings from other genres, aspects of performance art, minimalist and aleatory tendencies, and a pan-African world music sensibility. In many ways, the work of the AACM musicians signaled the first stirrings of postmodernism in jazz. Increasingly, the younger progressive players in the jazz world would temper their quest for new, radical sounds in favor of a pronounced eclecticism, one that included the embrace, sometimes the vivisection, of earlier styles and other traditions. In this postmodern sensibility, a two-stepping cakewalk could share the stage with an Ehlerian exercise in saxophone glossolalia. This postmodernism was also reflected in a deconstructive attitude toward the music, a desire to break down styles into their constituent elements, sometimes focusing on one isolated aspect, at other times combining the pieces into surprising new wholes. This music was capable of evoking the high seriousness of earlier progressive styles, but postmodernism also experimented with a range of other perspectives, including, but not limited to, pastiche, put-on, and parody. In this regard, the jazz world was following a path that other art forms had already trod. Its irreverent and encyclopedic approach to manipulating the materials at hand, largely made up of bits and pieces of past traditions, was comparable to contemporary techniques adopted by practitioners in literature, theater, and the visual arts. With the benefit of hindsight, we can see the roots of this new perspective in a number of projects from the 1960s and 1970s. Not just the AACM, but artists as diverse as Carla Bley and Frank Zappa were using jazz elements, alongside other fragments of cultural detritus, in a manner that can only be deemed postmodern. Bley's 1971 opera, Escalator Over the Hill, was an artful blend of free, jazz rock, and classical influences. A series of later Bley projects amplified on these diverse sources of influence, with a playful postmodern tinge often present, as in her Spangled Banner Minor, which scrambles the U.S. national anthem and other patriotic airs into a peculiar jumble of the familiar and strange. Other Bley pieces emulate the sound of a needle skipping on a phonograph record, or scales played by a student at a music lesson. Steve Lacy's work from this period also anticipated a number of currents that would crystallize in the work of such later postmodernists as Anthony Braxton, David Murray, and John Zorn, including a blending of a progressive aesthetic with an interest in celebrating past stylists, most notably Thelonious Monk in Lacy's case, as well as a commitment to frequent recording in diverse settings. Lacy's early career, which found him working in varied idioms from Dixieland to free, made it clear that his artistic vision held few prejudices, and his later efforts cast an even wider net, incorporating electronics, language, vocals, and dance. The New York loft scene of the 1970s drew on many of these postmodern tendencies and served as an especially fertile meeting ground for the different schools of progressive music trying to establish themselves in the jazz world. A series of recordings from 1976, drawn from performances at Rivbia Studio, the loft home of saxophonist Sam Rivers, and released under the name Wildflowers, showcased the tremendous heterogeneity of this hotbed of experimentalism. One of the bands highlighted was Air, a trio featuring saxophonist Henry Threadgill, bassist Fred Hopkins, and drummer Steve McCall, whose work was reflective of the emerging aesthetic and is likely to embrace Scott Joplin as Albert Ayler. In addition to his legacy with Air, Threadgill forged a fresh, highly experimental body of work with larger combos, drawing on sometimes surprising instruments, accordion, pipa, oud, tuba, French horn, etc. Most notably with his 1990s band, Very Very Circus. In these various settings, Threadgill's visionary music implied a rejection of existing jazz hierarchies and an egalitarian openness to a broad range of influences. After the often doctrinaire avant-garde attitudes of the 1960s, many musicians and fans welcomed this approach, one that avoided rigid adherence to any one school and celebrated the possibilities of sound over the rigidity of ideologies. These new currents would flow far beyond Chicago and New York. The work of Hamiet Bluett, Julius Hemphill, Oliver Lake, and other musicians associated with the Black Artists Group in St. Louis revealed a similarly expansive approach to jazz, which encompassed aspects of theater, poetry, and visual arts. On the West Coast, John Carter, who along with Bobby Bradford had formed a Los Angeles splinter group building on the avant-garde principles of Ornette Coleman, created a magnum opus of postmodernism during the 1980s with his five-volume Roots and Folklore project, which chronicled in words and music the history of African Americans. In Europe, Dutch reed player and composer Willem Bruecker would pursue a similarly eclectic postmodern style with his Collectief, which was formed in the mid-1970s. In Britain, Mike Westbrook brought everything from circus acts to the poetry of William Blake into his similarly expansive view of jazz performance. Yet the biggest boost to this deconstructive approach would come from the AACM musicians. The influence of Ayler still predominated on many of the early Chicago School recordings, but it began to coalesce with other postmodern elements in the evolving work of the Art Ensemble of Chicago. The Art Ensemble's motto, Great Black Music, Ancient to Modern, fittingly denoted their attitude toward the tradition. Fragments of gospel or funk might rub shoulders with dissonance and noise. A stately waltz might disintegrate into musical anarchy. Their fondness for unusual garb and makeup, and their borrowings from other genres, theater, dance, pantomime, comedy, validated the performance art elements that had long lurked below the surface of the jazz idiom. Their choices in instruments were equally diverse. Banjo, bassoon, bongos, bighorn, bells, and this is just a smattering of the listings under the letter B, and hundreds of other items made their way onto the bandstand along with the standard jazz brass and reed horns. The art ensemble initially featured Roscoe Mitchell, Joseph Jarman, Lester Bowie, Malachi Favors, and for a brief spell, drummer Philip Wilson. The band ignored the division of labor traditionally practiced by most jazz combos. Although Mitchell and Jarman periodically stood forth to brandish their saxophones in the front line, they were just as likely to be accompanists as lead soloists, just as inclined to play percussion or unusual wind instruments, conch shells or whistles, as the alto or tenor sax. Lester Bowie could show off his mastery of a wide range of trumpet styles, covering the gamut from pseudo-trad jazz growls and groans to up-to-date funk grooves. But he also might energize an art ensemble performance by pounding on the bass drum or engaging in quirky and sometimes humorous onstage antics. Malachi Favors served as bassist for the group, but almost any stringed instrument from banjo to zither might show up in his hands, as well as the ever-present percussion instruments that became art ensemble's trademarks. Indeed, the ensemble reportedly brought some 500 music-making implements with them when they moved to France at the close of the 1960s. The art ensemble caught the attention of European audiences in this new setting. Within a few months of arriving, the band had recorded a half dozen projects, including some of its finest work. The ensemble was very much in demand, with recording opportunities supplemented by frequent concerts, radio performances, and commissions for movie scores. During this period, percussionist Don Moy joined the group, and though this addition was lamented by some of the group's fans, who saw it as giving a more conventional rhythmic foundation to the art ensemble's free-flowing sound collages, Moy's background in free jazz and his wide-ranging collection of percussion instruments fit nicely with the ensemble's artistic impulses. By the same token, Moy added a more structured and overtly polyrhythmic, often more insistent, undercurrent to the band's sound. By the time of their return to the United States in April 1971, the expanded art ensemble had gained a reputation as a powerful exponent of what critic Gary Giddens aptly called guerrilla jazz. Their variegated approach borrowed from earlier styles while undermining them. No sound, no approach seemed out of place in the context of an art ensemble performance. Concerts and club appearances conveyed the band's essence in a way that the group's later studio sessions often only approximated. In truth, this band needed to be seen as well as heard. Dressed in African garb, their faces painted or wearing masks, surrounded by their little instruments, so many that it sometimes took 2 hours simply to set up the bandstand, the art ensemble presented a striking appearance that had few precedents in the jazz world. The group's various live recordings, such as Live at Mandel Hall, Baptism, and Urban Bushman, may stop short of documenting the total experience of the art ensemble in performance, but they still managed to convey the band's vitality and unpredictability, as well as its kaleidoscopic range. The Mandel Hall concert, for example, gyrates from fierce energy jazz to strutting backbeats and pensive interludes, interspersed with campy exhortations to the audience. The postmodernist wave of 1970s jazz found a brilliant exponent and champion in another Chicagoan, saxophonist Anthony Braxton. When viewed in its broadest outlines, Braxton's career bears a superficial resemblance to that of the art ensemble. Braxton, too, was an advocate of free jazz and an early member of AACM, and, like the art ensemble, he moved to Paris at the close of the 1960s. His recordings have sometimes featured him alongside other AACM musicians. Like them, his work crossed stylistic barriers, borrowing from a grab bag of genres. Yet Braxton, if anything, seemed to forage even more widely, could it be possible, than his Chicago contemporaries. Indeed, no other figure of the period more closely epitomized the postmodernist zeal to rework all earlier traditions, digest every possible style, incorporate each disparate sound into his oeuvre, all under the banner of progressivism. Just a glance at the instrumentation of Braxton's output tells much about his eclectic and eccentric approaches. He has written for two pianos, five tubas, even for four amplified shovels. One finds music for solo saxophone, for duo, trio, jazz quartet, string quartet, music for orchestra and four slide projectors, for orchestra and puppet theater, even music for four orchestras. Braxton succeeded brilliantly in tearing down the artificial barriers that had segregated the avant-garde jazz community, often stirring controversy in the process. In contrast to the art ensemble's motto of Great Black Music, Braxton daringly embraced European as well as African-American visions of contemporary music and was not afraid to include Schoenberg, Webern, Cage, and Stockhausen among his influences, alongside Coltrane, Coleman, and Ayler. Further, he broke down the barriers between free and straight-ahead jazz, raising eyebrows by a series of In the Tradition recordings featuring mainstream renditions of standards. He defied the dichotomies of white and black, still a stubbornly pervasive divide in the jazz world, by frequently lauding the music of Paul Desmond, Lee Konitz, and Warren Marsh, and by working in racially diverse ensembles such as the Circle Quartet, featuring Braxton, Chick Corea, Barry Altschul, and Dave Holland, or alongside Dave Brubeck, or with various European musicians. He ignored the categorization that separated free players into New York energy jazz advocates and Chicago sound landscapists. Finally, Braxton refused to recognize any conflict between the emotional and cerebral aspects of jazz, even inviting ridicule by his embrace of intellectual mannerisms, playing chess, smoking a pipe, dressing like an Ivy League academic, discoursing on philosophy, using pseudo-scientific diagrams rather than conventional titles for his compositions, a thoughtfulness that also permeated his music. One of the ironies of Braxton's career was that his tearing down of these Berlin walls within the jazz psyche, this acceptance of any source of inspiration, without prejudice or bias, won him so few friends. "I don't like Braxton," one anonymous elder statesman of jazz told a journalist. "I don't like that sweater. I don't like that pipe. I don't like that hair." Reviewing Braxton's career, critic Greg Tate concludes, "Braxton's talent for inspiring antipathy may be unrivaled by any living jazz creature." Braxton's diversity is amply represented by his prolific recorded output. His For Alto from 1968 legitimized the role of solo saxophone in contemporary jazz and was the most important effort of its kind since Coleman Hawkins' Picasso from the late 1940s. His Paris concert recording with the Ensemble Circle from 1971 indicated that Braxton's personal brand of abstraction could flourish in a hot-blooded jazz combo, perhaps best demonstrated by the quartet's intense reworking of the standard There Is No Greater Love. Braxton's recordings for the Arista label in the 1970s gave him unprecedented freedom to realize some of his more ambitious projects, including his Creative Orchestra Music, 1976, which showcased Braxton the composer in a definitive postmodern effort, almost a compendium of musical Americana. Here, Braxton shifts in mid-piece from a Sousa-esque march to Reich glass one-chord minimalism and Ehlerian saxophone spasms, elsewhere evoking Ellington or AACM stylings. Other Arista works of note ranged from intimate duos with Mahal Richard Abrams for the massive For Four Orchestras. His work with mainstream jazz forms came to the fore in his In the Tradition recordings from the 1970s and continued with late 1980s releases focusing on the music of Thelonious Monk and Lenny Tristano. Various combo recordings on Black Saint, Hat Art, and other labels have further documented the incessant probing and roving curiosity of this key figure. His recordings have never found the large audience that tuned into Armstrong or Basie or Coltrane or Davis, those ABCs of jazz popularity, but Braxton would eventually become, like many of the previous outsiders of the AACM, a savvy insider, earning a coveted genius grant from the MacArthur Foundation in 1994 and becoming a tenured professor at Wesleyan University. The major heroes of postmodern jazz have tended, like Braxton, to be prodigious in their output and omnivorous in their tastes. Few musicians have exemplified these traits to a greater extent than saxophonist David Murray. Before his 40th birthday, Murray had some 150 recordings, more or less, to his credit. These covered a dizzying range of formats and styles, from solo saxophone to big band, and most stages in between. It is a symptom of postmodern jazz in general, and Murray's career in particular, that attempts to describe this music tend to collapse into a listing of various influences. Certainly, jazz genealogists could spend a long time tracing the predecessors who have left their mark on one Murray recording or another. The title track of his celebrated early recording, Flowers for Albert, was dedicated to Albert Ayler, whose influence on Murray was evident, as was the impact of other avant-garde saxophonists such as Eric Dolphy and Ornette Coleman. But Murray would in time also be compared to a host of mainstream saxophone stylists, Sonny Rollins, John Coltrane, Paul Gonsalves, Eddie Lockjaw Davis, Ben Webster, even Sidney Bechet. with greater or lesser degrees of plausibility. Certainly Murray's career, as it evolved, came to reflect the growing distance between progressive jazz and freedom music, a chasm that opened in the 1970s and widened noticeably in the 1980s and 1990s. "The music has to start swinging again," Murray remarked in a 1983 interview. "I think it reflects the sociological aspects of the times. People don't want music they have to suffer through." Both as a composer and an instrumentalist, Murray pursued this ideal. In the process, he incorporated the influence of other great jazz composer players, especially Mingus and Ellington, as is most evident in his larger ensemble work. Murray's octet recordings for the Black Saint label were especially persuasive, recalling Mingus's knack for mixing formalism with a devil-may-care heedlessness. Sideman stints with James Blood Ulmer and Jack DeJohnette amplified on the breadth shown in the saxophonist's leader dates, while his work with the World Saxophone Quartet further testified to Murray's diversity. In later years, Murray increasingly would look outside the jazz world for inspiration, and his mid-career projects include a series of collaborative efforts with traditional Guadeloupean guoca percussionists, a music-meets-poetry partnership with Amiri Baraka, and even the release of a tribute album devoted to the Grateful Dead. The World Saxophone Quartet, where Murray worked alongside Julius Hemphill, Oliver Lake, and Hamiet Bluett, was founded in 1976 during the course of a visit to New Orleans to give seminars and concerts when the foursome discovered that audiences responded most favorably to their work without a rhythm section. The concept of four horns interacting without further support invites comparisons with a classical string quartet. Yet the WSQ defied any expectations of chamber music snobbishness. They made music that cut across boundaries, that might doff its hat at Ellington one moment, veer into atonality the next, or set a groove drawing on African music, soul, or R&B. A series of releases on the Elektra label, Plays Duke Ellington, Rhythm and Blues, Metamorphosis, with African percussion, demonstrated the WSQ's expertise in these different genres, while earlier recordings for the Black Saint label, such as Steppin' with the World Saxophone Quartet, Review, and Live in Zurich, served as effective showcases for the compositional skills of the individual members. Hemphill had grown up in Fort Worth, Texas, where he had gained familiarity with the city's rhythm and blues tradition, as well as with its progressive jazz currents, which Hemphill assimilated firsthand in the course of his studies with John Carter. Lake also boasted deep roots in the free jazz scene, having led the St. Louis-based Black Artist Group. In the early 1970s, Lake worked in Paris with other BAG musicians before moving to New York. Bluett had also been associated with the Black Artist Group before moving to New York in 1969, where he worked with Sam Rivers and Charles Mingus. Each of the four original members of the World Saxophone Quartet was a skilled composer, but much of the magnetism of their playing came from the artful balance between structure and spontaneity, between following the written scores and leaving them behind. Hemphill's health problems, including diabetes and heart surgery, ended his fruitful partnership at the end of the 1980s, but the remaining members maintained the WSQ, with Arthur Blythe, John Purcell, and other saxophonists filling Hemphill's chair in later years. Postmodern currents in all the arts have typically come to embrace the use of parody and pastiche as the ultimate tools in deconstructing inherited traditions. The deadly seriousness of the first generation of avant-garde pioneers is eventually succeeded by a glib, irreverent hipness, a path that quickly takes us from the steely abstractions of cubism to Campbell's soup cans on canvas. In the jazz world, no artist has been more representative of the Warholian spirit than saxophonist and composer John Zorn. While a student at Webster College in the early 1970s, Zorn had been inspired by the music of the AACM and the Black Artists Group. But like many of the other new faces of the 1980s and 1990s New York downtown scene, including fellow postmodernists and collaborators such as Tim Byrne, Wayne Horvitz, Bill Frisell, and Bobby Previtt, Zorn pushed the eclecticism of his models a step beyond, even surpassing a Murray or Threadgill in his unexpected choices for source materials. His tastes wander far beyond the jazz world, and on any given project may include punk rock, aleatory music, klezmer, or spaghetti western film scores, among other genres. Often these styles are juxtaposed in surprising ways, an oral equivalent of channel surfing, inspiring, for instance, Ornette Coleman compositions played with the frantic energy of a heavy metal band, or the theme from a James Bond movie sprinkled with a seasoning of electronic noise. Zorn's work falls into a number of broad categories. His game pieces provide an alternative to the chord and meter-based structures of mainstream jazz in favor of more or less complex instructions, in essence, the rules of the game, that establish a framework for the composition without specifying any preferred outcome. His release Cobra provides a glimpse at the different possible outcomes resulting from a specific game piece for 12 musicians, although the hand signals that direct the flow of the piece are not adequately conveyed by the recording. For all their limitations, such works attempt to rediscover the essential jazz celebration of process over the certainties of a finished product, in the same manner as a Japanese tea ceremony differs from the merely functional cup of dinner coffee. A second body of work, including Zorn projects such as Naked City and The Big Gundown, featuring the music of Ennio Morricone, is driven by Zorn's fascination with cinema, especially genres such as westerns, gangster movies, and film noir. He has written a number of cinematic scores himself, usually for independent filmmakers, and often for documentaries, and his music is rich in implied visual corollaries. Other Zorn projects might focus on facets of world music, a specific jazz figure, whether famous, Ornette Coleman, or semi-obscure, Sonny Clark, or dip into contemporary classical music, Forbidden Fruit, written for the Kronos String Quartet. Trumpeter Dave Douglas first came to the attention of many jazz fans while working with Zorn's Masada Group in the early 1990s. This band's blending of klezmer and avant-garde jazz could almost serve as an emblem of the self-conscious postmodern posture. Yet Douglas was also recording works by Igor Stravinsky, Anton Webern, and Duke Ellington on his debut soul note leader date, Parallel Worlds, from this same period, and only a few years earlier had been playing hard bop tunes in Horace Silver's band. His later career highlights have included a spirited tribute to Mary Lou Williams, Soul on Soul from 2000, but with almost all of the Kansas City jazz elements strangely purged from the music, and Douglas's work with his Tiny Bells Trio, which started out focused on Eastern European folk material, but eventually encompassed a vertiginous array of genres. Douglas's ability to master many vocabularies is striking, yet the range of his work is so wide that he risks comparisons not with Miles or Dizzy, but rather with those crack Hollywood studio players who can play a country music session in the morning, record a commercial jingle in the afternoon, and show up on a reggae date in the evening. In a jazz scene that sometimes seems like a land grab, few artists have staked out more territory than Zorn and Douglas. And where the early postmodernists found eclecticism a means of refreshing their styles, this second wave of adherents has increasingly relied on it as the central value of their careers. Guitarist Bill Frisell, too, has exhibited at times a taste for genre hopping and pastiche, but his work more often reflects a singular focus and a rare concern, given his cultural surroundings, with preserving an individual and identifiable style. Even on his most decidedly eclectic project, Have a Little Faith, an impressive tour of musical Americana from Sousa, Copeland, and Ives to Dylan, Rollins, and Madonna, Frisell's viewpoint avoids reduction into mere satirical distance, and on his Dis Farmer album from 2009, he achieves a stark and moving unity of purpose that has more in common with roots music than postmodern deconstruction. Although he is quick to praise the many guitarists who have influenced him, from Jim Hall to Jimi Hendrix, his playing retains an unmistakable originality that defies any tracing of guitar licks back to original sources. His undulating lines convey a minimalist aesthetic married to a painter's concern with color, texture, and tone. And though Frisell is enamored with the use of various electronic tools to distort his guitar sound, he typically uses them as means toward deeper artistic expression, not as ends in themselves. For all the superficial diversity of his efforts, Frisell's musical landscapes are mostly painted in washed-out pastels, depicting sparsely populated settings under blanched horizons. The moody, ruminative side of this artist is well documented on a number of jazz-oriented leader dates for the ECM and none such labels, but it also plays a role in his genre-crossing pop culture projects, which range from collaborations with rock icons such as Ginger Baker and Elvis Costello, to soundtrack music for everything from television cartoons to Buster Keaton's silent movies. This ragtag postmodernism seemed to lose some steam in the new millennium, as the jazz world took on a more institutional and reverential tone. But a number of provocative examples showed that radical juxtapositions of different genres and traditions could still delight and even, a rarity given the I've-seen-it-all attitude of seasoned clubhoppers by this time, surprise the audience. The Bad Plus, a collective trio established by pianist Ethan Iverson, bassist Reed Anderson, and drummer Dave King in 2000, tweaked its combined noses at jazz snobs and found a sizable audience of jazz newbies with cover versions of songs by Nirvana, Black Sabbath, the Bee Gees, and similarly outre material. A 2009 video released by the band finds the Bad Plus performing a dauntingly avant-garde work by classical composer Milton Babbitt, while sexy dancing girls cavort in the foreground. Jason Moran has similarly constructed a career that straddles genres and categories. This Houston-born pianist first made his name in the late 1990s as sideman with saxophonist Greg Osby, a relationship that led to Moran signing with the Blue Note label, where his releases have shown a restless urgency in which almost any type of sound, acoustic, electronic, spoken, looped, can serve as an ingredient. On Moran's compact disc, The Bandwagon, a cover version of Brahms coexists with high-octane free jazz and a musical composition built around a woman speaking on her cell phone in Turkish. His 2009 In My Mind project incorporated multimedia effects into a musical tribute to a Thelonious Monk town hall concert that took place 50 years earlier. Yet Moran is equally comfortable working sans cell phone and slide projector within the mainstream jazz tradition, and from time to time has shown up in the bands of an impressive if diverse range of bandleaders, including Joe Lovano, Charles Lloyd, Cassandra Wilson, Lee Konitz, and Dave Holland. At his most characteristic moments, he builds thick and sometimes overpowering sound textures at the keyboard, where the listener seems to be following an aural tropical storm, surging and abating from moment to moment, rather than a conventional solo over chord changes. Pianist Uri Kane, another champion of postmodern attitudes, has specialized in similarly radical reconfigurations, often of works drawn from the classical repertoire, as demonstrated on Ehrlich Primal Light, 1997. The Goldberg Variations, 2000, Uri Kane Ensemble Plays Mozart, 2006, and The Othello Syndrome, 2008. Whereas in the past, jazz artists had looked to highbrow role models as ways of uplifting the art form, the Third Stream Movement of the 1950s was perhaps the most ambitious program of this nature, the later postmodernists treat the work of serious composers as just one more example of cultural bric-a-brac available for manipulation and expropriation. After hearing Kane's version of Bach's Goldberg Variations, where, if you wait long enough, almost every style of music, samba, gospel, klezmer, electronica, etc., shows up, the listener will find it hard to remember why people got so hot under the collar when Glenn Gould played this work on the piano instead of the harpsichord. Clarinetist Don Byron has frequently collaborated with Kane, Moran, Frissell, and other jazz postmodernists, and his personal aesthetic vision shows a similar delight in genre bending and juxtaposition. In various projects, he has celebrated klezmer music, updated 19th century classical compositions, championed fringe composers such as Raymond Scott, Junior Walker, and Mickey Katz, and played the standard jazz repertoire from a variety of angles, with perspectives from both inside and outside the changes. One seeks in vain for the defining elements of Byron's style, and would do better to see his work, as well as that of many of his contemporaries, as embracing a jittery anti-style that seeks constantly to redefine its own parameters and limits. Although the term postmodernism might suggest an end point for jazz history, a happily ever after where all ingredients combine in ever fresh recipes, the period of ascendancy of this freewheeling philosophy may have already passed. So much of the power of this music derives from the shock value attendant on its violation of boundaries and transgression of norms. Yet this element of surprise is harder to come by with each passing year. The juggling of different jazz vocabularies will never entirely lose its piquancy, but these mashups hardly have the same jolt in the new millennium that they did in the 1980s and 1990s. In the aftermath of this age of cut and paste, with its aural collages made from snippets of everything from Ehler to Zorn, a more earnest and focused tone seems to be coming to the fore in the art form. Chapter 10. Jazz in the New Millennium. Virtual Jazz. Even back in the 1970s, the jazz world understood that technology would change the music. Yet most performers, if pushed for particulars at the time, would have talked about the spread of synthesizers and keyboards, advances in electric guitars, and the impact of various other plugged-in devices on the bandstand. Who would have thought, back in those heroic days of jazz fusion musicians strutting like rock stars, that the real technological revolution would take place a generation later, but mostly offstage, in the ways music is conceived, recorded, distributed, marketed, and shared? Welcome to the jazz scene of the new millennium, where the music itself is evolving more slowly than everything surrounding it. As I sit writing, I have two catalogs in front of me, both apparently sent as junk mail to the addressees of musicians and wannabe performers. "You're not dreaming," proclaims the cover of one of them. 1,000 CDs and jewel cases, now just $890. Make your own compact discs for less than a dollar each. Who needs a record label? The other brochure quotes slightly higher prices but offers everything from eco-friendly packaging, with the CD trays made from recycled soda and water bottles, to promotion services that promise to get a compact disc with musician's songs into the hands of radio DJs, promoters, managers, record labels, and potential licensors. What a dramatic change from the old days when an unproven musician who wanted to release an album needed to convince the man, and invariably it was a man, at one of the small number of record labels to take a chance on a new artist. Nowadays, anyone and everyone can release a CD with a modest investment, paid for by a few gigs. And judging by the number of jazz compact discs coming out every month, countless musicians are taking advantage of this opportunity to become their own label. In the last year, I have received more than 1,000 jazz CDs in the mail, sent to me in hopes that I would write a review, most of them financed and released by the artist. By my estimate, there were probably a couple thousand more that were released but never made it to my mailbox, an oversight for which the postal worker who covers my block is deeply grateful. If one measures the success of the jazz scene by the quantity of product out there, then we are living in the golden age. More jazz recordings are released in a single month now than came out in an entire year back in the 1950s. The irony is that this profusion of compact discs is happening at the very time that the CD is no longer necessary and is under attack from nimbler virtual ways of distributing music. Recordings can now be sent around the world at no cost with a click of a mouse, no disc required, and even more eco-friendly than a recycled Pepsi bottle. Millions of tracks are available for purchase on dozens of websites, and even if you don't want to spend any money, plenty is offered for free or accessible from various illegal sources. Musicians can easily find electronic distributors for their songs or, as they are increasingly doing, setting up their own web presence to promote and sell their work. Just as performers in the past needed membership in the Musicians Union or a cabaret card to launch their careers, nowadays they require a profile on MySpace, a Twitter account, and a Facebook page. A search for jazz on YouTube comes back with more than 1 million hits. The ways this technological revolution is impacting jazz are both subtle and profound, with the digital track increasingly usurping the role once held by live performance. At the Punkt Jazz Festival in Norway, audience members can go to the Alpha Room immediately after a concert and experience a live remix of the music they just heard, with DJs and guest musicians reworking the songs assisted by a stage full of equipment. Indeed, the remix is the heart of the festival, and often more exciting than the initial performance. Back in the States, trumpeter Dave Douglas performs in a jazz club, and a few hours later is selling downloads of the music on his website. Cross-border jams are harder, given the time lag in sound traveling long distances. Yet in 2007, Dave Brubeck pulled off a live performance with a BBC orchestra, during which the pianist was in a studio in Rockefeller Plaza in New York, while the orchestra and conductor were facing the audience in London. Of course, you don't need to be a star to jam over the web these days. And if you aren't ready for the competition, online music lessons are easily available on numerous sites. Get some tips from an established pro in New York or Hollywood without leaving your apartment in Budapest or Bangalore. In North Carolina, a startup company called Zenf Studios is producing jazz recordings without any musicians at all, creating software equivalents of great performers of the past, virtual pianists and virtual bassists that are essentially indistinguishable from the originals. Inexpensive software packages such as Finale and Sibelius allow composers the privilege of hearing orchestral realizations of their work without the need to hire a single performer. In short, Every aspect of the jazz world from conception to consumption is being transformed by technology. Not many jazz musicians use the word disintermediation in their conversations. It is a term more often heard in corporate boardrooms, but this may well be the most important trend impacting their careers in the coming decades. Disintermediation describes the removal of key participants in an economic process because they no longer add sufficient value to justify their roles. In popular parlance, it is called cutting out the middleman. Who needs record stores if music is sold over the internet? Who needs a record distributor if no stores are left? Who needs a company to make a physical CD if a download is just as good? Who needs an agent if an artist can deal directly with club owners and concert promoters via the web and email? Who needs a musician if software equivalents are just as good and much less expensive? Of course, you can't dispense with everybody, and especially not with the consumer, increasingly an endangered species in jazz. But now all participants in the jazz value chain need to justify their contribution and defend themselves against the encroachment of others. In this environment, jazz musicians have been forced to become entrepreneurs and savvy managers of their own careers. Not too long ago, it was a great rarity when a jazz artist such as Marion McPartland or Horace Silver decided to launch a homegrown record label. In the new millennium, this is commonplace. In fact, far more typical than the old model of an independent company taking on the risk of promoting an artist. New types of organizations are also emerging to empower artists and create support networks in this changed environment. The Artist Share Company, founded by Brian Camilleo in 2001, allows musicians to tap their own audience base to fund creative projects. Fans who make contributions get special perks, which might even include an invitation to the recording session or having their name printed in the liner notes to the resulting compact disc. When an artist shares fan-funded project, Maria Schneider's Concert in the Garden from 2004 won a Grammy, one of the key donors, listed as executive producer on the project, was invited to join Schneider at the award ceremony. Certainly this label, although Camilleo is ambivalent about the term when applied to his business model, is no mere vanity outfit for the musician not talented enough to get a real record deal. Some of the finest jazz artists on the scene, Jim Hall, Bob Brookmeyer, Chris Potter, Brian Lynch, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Billy Childs, and others have embraced the concept and, as Schneider's Grammy honors attest, the resulting projects present some of the best jazz on the market. Could it be that this economic model, which bears an uncanny resemblance to the arrangements between composers and patrons that emerged back when the musical arts were first adapting to the dictates of capitalism, is also conducive to great art-making? Certainly it represents a realistic response to the economic marginalization of jazz as an art form and the pressures of reconciling creative goals with dollars and cents practicalities. Perhaps the increasingly unstable financial situation of the jazz world explains the greater tone of seriousness that seems to have entered the music in the new millennium. The ironic attitudes that have been so common among the first wave of postmodern players in the 1980s and 1990s have lessened. The playful mixing and matching of genres still takes place, but far less often, and above all, a new earnestness permeates the scene. Several factors have no doubt contributed to this state of affairs. After 9/11, a number of pundits proclaimed the death of irony and the economic malaise of the decade did little to lighten the cultural tone, which even outside of the music industry is increasingly brusque and down-to-earth. But one suspects that a change in attitude in the jazz world would have emerged under any circumstances, just as we have witnessed similar shifts from playful to serious approaches in earlier decades, for example with the rise of bebop in the mid-1940s, and the emergence of the avant-garde 15 years later. No artist reflects this earnest attitude more decidedly than pianist Brad Meldow. It is not just his tendency to quote German philosophers in his liner notes that contributes to this perception. An academic paper available for download on the pianist's website is titled "Smashing the Framework with a Piano Hammer, an Interpretation of Nietzschean Existentialism in the Music of Brad Meldow." Nor is it Meldow's dour mien on his CD covers, where he seems to have a deep set aversion to showing even a glimmer of a smile. Rather, the singular gravitas of Meldow's artistry comes most to the fore on the bandstand, where he combines the cerebral and lyrical in artful reconfigurations of popular songs and his own sharply etched compositions. The vehemence of this music is all the more striking when one considers Meldow's marked preference for pop and rock material that has only the loosest links to the jazz repertoire. He is just as likely to draw on the Beatles and Paul Simon for his set lists as on Monk and Train, and Meldow's example is the key reason why songs by Radiohead and Nick Drake have now become jazz standards. That said, don't expect to hear his versions on